Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Now, this morning we've got Bob Edwards here. He's from the Australian National University, and his talk is called YubiKey Authentication in a Mid-sized Organisation.
Well, thanks very much for coming along this morning and having me here at LCA. Just a word warning that this talk is somewhat more technical, perhaps, than some of the other talks this morning. Not covering social or legal issues so much more about, in fact, in some ways it might be seen as the antithesis of the idea of sharing. We're talking about privacy and authentication. I have a worldview that says that there are bad people out there and that those bad people do sometimes want to take things that they ought not to. And so authentication comes out of that. I work in a university, by the way. We have students. So I start off with this statement: reusable passwords are dead. What I really mean is that they've well and truly passed their use-by date. The idea that you might have a password that you use over and over again to authenticate yourself to various services, especially on the web or remote logins or VPNs, etc., is an anachronism from the last millennia. Reusable passwords are based on something that I know. Knowledge can and should be shared. So if you have a password, maybe something you should share. Passwords, I find, as I'm getting older and older, are relatively hard to remember. I have lots of passwords, and there are all sorts of tools on my computer to help me arrange and organise them, but nonetheless, I often find myself in situations where I can't remember a particular password for a system and need to go and look it up somewhere. On the other hand, passwords, reusable passwords, are relatively easy for others to discover. And some of the discovery mechanisms would include social engineering, such as the phishing attacks that we've all become used to, and all the other social, you know, telephone calls, etc. Of course, brute force attack, people just trying lots of different password combinations until they hit one that will work for your account. And another important one, I guess, would be key capture. So either someone doing something, looking over a shoulder, or perhaps having some hardware installed somewhere that watches keystrokes on a keyboard, or perhaps there's some software, some malware on a computer that is watching the keyboard keystrokes and logging them away somewhere. So these are all good reasons not to use reusable passwords. And an alternative is the use of one-time passwords, OTP. The idea there, of course, is that passwords get used once and then discarded. If such a password gets captured by any of the mechanisms I just mentioned, it doesn't really matter because the system that you're authenticating against, once it's seen a particular password, won't recognise that password again. One-time passwords were, have been used for centuries, and in the war, in particular, World War II, the use of one-time pads, I think also other wars, the use of one-time pads was quite prevalent. So both ends of a communication would get printed lists of passphrases that they would use for encoding their messages. And provided those pads didn't fall into enemy hands, they were able to go through and use each passphrase one at a time. As they used each passphrase, they could cross it off and use those passphrases to encrypt their communications. And of course, these days we use automatic mechanisms for generating one-time passwords. And I guess one of the more well-known ones is the RSA Secure ID token. I've got one of those here. And this picture is taken from, I should give attribution, it's not written on there, but it's from, that picture's from Wikipedia, whatever it's called, the images library under Creative Commons. Also, there's a mechanism called S-Key, or it's got a new name these days, which I can't think of at the moment, generated using a mobile phone or some sort of calculator or something. And the mechanism I want to talk about today is called YubiKey. And for those of you who haven't seen a YubiKey, I was going to get a picture up, but it's not there. That's a YubiKey, and that's another YubiKey. There's a couple of them up here. And in fact, I'll pass around these UV keys. You can have a closer look at them. I wouldn't mind having them back. They're relatively low cost, but still better if I didn't lose them. They're relatively indestructible. The white one is a YubiKey 2.0, which got released a few months ago, and the black one is a YubiKey 1.0. The 1.0 actually weighs about half as much as the 2.0, and it's a little bit thinner, but apparently somewhat more fragile. And before we talk a lot more about YubiKeys, I want to talk about multi-factor authentication. So one-time passwords based on something that you have, a physical item. It could be a one-time pad, a dongle such as a YubiKey, or one of these secure ID type devices, or some sort of calculator. Of course, if that dongle or that thing that you have is stolen or borrowed temporarily, then your authentication, of course, becomes compromised. And so we often combine one-time passwords or the passwords that based on something that you have with a reusable password. So there's a combination of something you know and something you have, and both items are required together, both factors are required together. That's called two-factor authentication. And so stealing a YubiKey on its own isn't going to help if the person doesn't also know your password, and vice versa. If they find out your password but they can't get hold of your YubiKey, then it's useless. And banks these days are using two-factor authentication a lot for online transactions. My bank uses a SMS system when I try and add a new recipient for funds transfers to my account. They send me a 6-digit code via SMS to my mobile phone, and I need to type that in within a minute back into their website to prove that the mobile phone that they sent the SMS to was somewhere nearby me when I was trying to do this transaction, and therefore I was able to authenticate. Now, of course, when banks do that, they're actually, in some sense, outsourcing their authentication to a telephone company. If you can somehow convince a telephone company to temporarily divert SMSs from your normal phone to an attacker's phone, then of course their system falls down a bit. And so what they've actually done is they've said, well, we trust that the telcos have proper mechanisms in place not to divert SMSs to other recipients. And I guess they take a risk. I guess there's a risk management process has been undertaken by the banks in working out what the likelihood of that happening is. But yeah, it's worth thinking through what actually happens there when a bank uses an SMS to help with your authentication. Okay, so on to YubiKeys. And by the way, if you want to interrupt at any point and ask questions, I'm quite happy for that. YubiKeys are developed by a company in Sweden called Yubico. I'm not that familiar with the history of YubiKo, but I believe that the whole thing came about as part of a project that an engineering student undertook several years ago, and it's all become commercialised. The entire YubiKey system is open source. There's no vendor lock-in. That's again a difference with the VeriSign the RSA secure ID tag, which is very much locked in to the vendor, and you can only use it against servers that RSA supply. YubiKeys, all the protocols and all the other information required to implement the system is completely open source, and so you don't have to buy YubiKeys from Yubico. You can build your own if you want to, and you certainly don't need to use their servers. And in fact, the basis of this talk is me discussing a server that I wrote for use at the Australian National University. The advantages of YubiKeys, that they're small. The YubiKey is a lot smaller and lighter than, for example, the RSA tag. This is the one I normally use on my key ring. So it just sits there happily against keys and stuff. Hardly even notice that it's there. It's easy to use, and I'll demonstrate that in a moment. Very cheap. So I've bought two sets so far in lots of 10, and they're worked out, delivered to my desk in Australia at $32 each by the time that all gets paid for. But if I bought 500, the price would be around about $12 each. Again, it's a lot cheaper than the secure ID tags. And there's no batteries. In fact, there's no built-in obsolescence at all. So as long as the hardware continues to work, you'll be able to continue to use YubiKey basically for as long as you like. So I anticipate that probably lasts for a number of years, three to 5 years. Unlike, again, the secure ID tag, which actually has a timer built into it, which turns it off after 2 years. So regardless of how much battery power is left, it just turns itself off after 2 years and that's it. And there's possibly good reasons why you want to do that, but it forces you to go and get a new one. So a YubiKey looks to any computer, such as the Linux machine I'm using here, like a USB keyboard. It uses the USB HID interface. And so when I plug it in, my computer believes it has a new keyboard. And I'll just demonstrate that. So at the risk of losing my presentation, I will bring up an editor. And when I press the button on the YubiKey, what it does is it prints out this this password. It's got 44 characters. The first 12 characters are a fixed identifier to identify that YubiKey. I can actually change it. That's all programmable. But the intention is that that would always be at the beginning of every key sequence. And so if I do another one, you can see the first 12 characters of the password are the same. And that helps the server at the other end look up in the database which YubiKey it's going to authenticate. The rest of the message, the other 22 characters, are a hex encoding using a special. We'll discuss how it's done, but you can see there there's a hodgepodge of lowercase characters. And every time I press the key, it will generate a different sequence. Security is based on a secret AES 128-bit key, and again, that's an open-source, patent unencumbered encryption standard, reasonably well understood. As far as we know, it's relatively well secure. Uses the ECB mode, which I think is enhanced code block or something, extended code block mode of AES. But basically, each YubiKey will have its own 128-bit AES key in it, and provided you know what that key is at the server end, you can decrypt the one-time password, confirm that it's correct, and authenticate that user. And there's no need to type anything. So unlike using a S-key calculator or a secure ID tag or a one-time pad, I don't actually need to press any keys on my keyboard. I just press that one button once, and it does all the work for me. So a typical use, I guess most of the use cases that you would see on the YubiKey website would involve authenticating with a web server. So we have the client system over here. Do I have a pointer here somewhere? Anyway, client system over here, which is just your internet cafe machine or a PC running at a friend's. Oh, thank you very much. Point that way. A system at your friend's house that you don't know what kind of virus protection they've put on it, etc. Connected to a server, some service running on this web server, and the server itself will call out to some authentication service that knows about YubiKey. Now, the idea is that this part of the thing, the client system and the communications between the client system and the server, is untrusted. You don't know who's listening in, you don't know what man in the middle there might be, or anything else. You don't know what key scanners there might be running on this system. It doesn't really matter. YubiKey will pass the key through, the one-time password through across the server, and then the server will authenticate using a trusted connection. It might be worth mentioning at this point also, for those of you familiar with Kerberos and Active Directory, etc., that Kerberos is good for when this part here is untrusted, the link between the client and the server, but Kerberos emphatically requires the client to be trusted. So the client itself must not be compromised for Kerberos to work properly. So one-time passwords kind of go a step further than what the Kerberos type system does by actually assuming that the client itself might not be trustworthy. So I'll just show you a demo. So this YubiKey 2.0, which arrived in the post a couple of weeks ago, I've authenticated against Yubico's server earlier, and I'll show you how that works. So I can we read that? Okay, so it's got several different modes. There's a mode where it just runs all by itself with no username or password, and I'm going to show that. So you just simply put the cursor in the box, press the button, and it actually sends a carriage return. It's programmed to send the carriage return at the end of the sequence, so you don't have to type anything else. It's authenticated me. It knows who I am because of that initial 12-character sequence. So I've had a previous account called Bob Edwards. This one's Bob Edwards 2. So it knows who I am, and that's all authenticated. Now, earlier I typed some passwords into this text editor, which are now old passwords. And if I take one of them and paste it into here, if I can get focus, and it doesn't have a carriage return. Okay, so it says login failure. So what's actually happened there, that was a valid password, but because I'd actually subsequently generated some other passwords from that one, all the previous passwords that YubiKey's ever generated are no longer valid. So I've basically tried to replay an old password and it said, no go. Question? Absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll discuss that as well. And this server is also set up to allow me to log in with a username and password. So you all know that my username is BobEdwards2. And my password is BobEdwards. And I'll put in one of those. And again, it's now this time authenticated me using username and password as well as the one-time password. So something I knew plus something I had. So it's a simple demo, but it basically means that as a YubiKey supplied to you, they know what the AES 128-bit key is that they programmed onto this YubiKey when they sold it, and they can use the 12-character string at the beginning of the one-time password sequence, look that one up, and say, yep, we don't know whose key it is, but we know what this AES 128-bit key is, and we can authenticate it properly using that. And if somebody claims to own it, then they can authenticate through the server. And so that means that I could actually start rolling out, without actually doing any more real work, I could start issuing some YubiKeys to people and roll out some applications that authenticate against YubiKey's public server, and that would all be good, unless you're me and you don't trust other people. Where's my slide gone? Okay, so YubiKey offer this public authentication server. If you were going to rely on it for some sort of production work, obviously you would need to do evaluations of how good the internet connection is to them, what sort of guarantees they can give you in terms of the availability of their server. And you may also want to know something about how will they protect the keys at their end so that somebody can't come along and get into to their database at the back end and find out the keys that you're using. So it's there, it's usable, but for the purposes that I was looking at, it wasn't appropriate. For a start, YubiKey know your secret 128-bit key, and you don't. I don't know what the keys are that they programmed into these, and I can't find out. All I can do is change them. Okay, so you need to trust YubiKey for authentication, for availability, and for confidentiality. And you don't know if they're going to sell the company to someone from the Russian mafia in the future or something. This is how the one-time passwords are generated. So this is a 16-byte sequence. There's a little microprocessor inside the chip. It's actually, as far as I understand, it's a little Atmel chip, the same one that's used in the Arduinos. And when you press the button, so there's two things that it knows about. One is it knows when it gets powered up. So when you plug it into the USB port, it detects that that's a new power-up sequence. And it starts counting. There's a little counter that starts counting from when it's first powered up in eighth of second steps. And so as I generate keys, that timestamp gets added in. But, of course, it resets each time I plug it back in. So inside each one is a unique 6-byte key, as well as the 12-character sequence on the front of the password. There's another 6-byte key inside, programmed inside the part of the password that gets encrypted, and that doesn't change, so that's basically fixed. Then we have this thing called a session counter. The session counter is incremented by one each time you actually power up the YubiKey. So it's a 16-bit counter, so it will overflow. Apparently it'll overflow every 5 years if you insert it 20 times a day. I think that's the right number. So you'd have to be plugging in and out quite a few times. You can reprogram the YubiKey whenever you like and reset the counter back to zero. So that's not a problem if your servers your server, it has to keep track of that number, and your server can indicate to you when it's getting to a high value and let you know this YubiKey probably should be reprogrammed. The timestamp, 3-byte timestamp, that's this the little number gets incremented 8 times a second, and that should always be incrementing during a particular value of the session counter. The timestamp number should always be incrementing for a successive password attempts. Then we have a session token counter, which gets incremented by 1 for each password generated during a particular session. So again, it should increment. For any given value of a session counter, that token counter should be incrementing by 1 as well. Then we have a pseudo-random value, 2 bytes, which gets added in there to make it really, really hard to detect the 128-bit key by grabbing a sequence of passwords and then doing some kind of analysis on it. And finally, there's a 16-bit checksum, which is obviously the first thing you want to check once you decrypt the key, make sure the checksum's valid. So what this basically means is that for any valid one-time password that I might generate when I press the button, the next valid one-time password, there's a very large number of valid one-time passwords that can come next, and there's a much larger number of invalid ones. So the secret ID is going to be the same. It'll have to match. The session counter might have incremented by 0 to some large number. The timestamp, if the session counter stayed the same, the timestamp should have incremented by any amount. The token counter should have incremented by some number, etc. So all that information gets added together in a 16-byte sequence, and then the whole thing is encrypted with the 128-bit encryption. And then we prepend the 6 bytes of the public ID to give us a... So there's 16 bytes here still after the encryption step. This 6 bytes gets prepended to give a 22-byte sequence. And then it goes through this final step, which is called mod hex encode, which is something that YubiKey came up with. The idea is that it's basically converting the 22-byte number into hexadecimal, but instead of using 0 to 9 A to F, what they've actually done is they've picked a particular pattern of keys on the keyboard which are unlikely to be modified by locality codes that in particular get used in Europe. I don't know if they've actually gone all around the world and looked at, for example, Southeast Asian countries and stuff like that, but I'm pretty certain that they've only looked at the European keyboards. But in particular, I think in Germany the Z and X keys might be swapped or something like that. So what they've done is they've picked a sequence or a group of keys on the keyboard which are always going to generate the same key code on all European keyboards. so that that's a sequence that they generate. It doesn't matter what locality setting your computer might have for the keyboard, it will always generate the appropriate 16 encodings to go through. And you saw an example of that a moment ago. Any questions about the modhex encoding or any of that? For a QWERTY keyboard, yeah, I believe so. Yeah, if you had VoIP, it would probably totally break it. There is a number of shortcomings which I'll go through, but yeah, that would certainly be one of them. The random value is a pseudo random number generator, and it, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. The point is, it's just adding some degree of entropy into the sequence before it gets encoded, so that it's basically much, much harder to do a brute force kind of analysis to try and work out what the 128-bit key is. Sure, it's pseudo-random. It's defined in the documentation as being pseudo-random, so you can imagine, you know... Yes, when you reprogram it, the session count is automatically set to zero. You can't change it to any other value. No. The only way to change it is to actually physically press the button and insert it and pull it out however many times. And this is actually a problem because people have lost their YubiKey and asked YubiKey for a new one, and there's some charge associated with it. And apparently they have a machine which simulates the thing being unplugged. However many times it got up, their server said, you know, your key had been inserted 450 times. They have to simulate 450 insert events in order to get the key back to the same state that it would have been in before you lost it. So, yeah.
YubiKey is effectively... You can blank it and make it identical to another one.
Sure.
And then crank the session counter up.
Sure. Yep. You could certainly do that.
But what can you actually reprogram?
So you can change the 128-bit key. That's the most important thing. You can change this value here. That's it. Everything else gets set back to zero when you reprogram. Sorry, there's three things you change. You change that, and you change that. They're the three things that can be changed. Yeah, you basically, because if you've lost it, you don't want anyone else to use it, so you basically disable it on the authentication server, so this key is no longer valid. Well, they're so cheap that the point is that they're cheap enough that you just discard it and use a new one. Disable the old one, start a new one. Right. So if it's a key that's been is still authenticating against YubiKey's server, I don't know your key. You don't know your key. Nobody knows. Only they do. You're going to have to ask them. You have to say, you know. But how are you going to identify it? The keys don't actually have anything written on them, so there's not even a way to identify it. You'll have to know something about the key, I suppose, to tell them. But they'd probably say, look, here's a new key. You know, buy a new one, and we'll just change it over. That's the point of the system is that it's very easy to disable a key. So if one gets lost, just stop it. No, you if using their server, that's right, you can't, because nobody else knows. Can we hold that question to the end and it might become clearer? There's an image there which I'll show in the next slide. The previous slide, I beg your pardon, that was the image. That's where the image came from, Linux Journal, and I've lost the end of it. 128-bit data frame contains 48-bit secret key. So basically, that's just what I just said. Modhex, 16-bit character alphabet using most common 16 keys across a wide range of Latin keyboards, and QWERTY, as you said. Okay, so reprogramming the YubiKey. You could ask YubiKo to supply AES128-bit keys for your YubiKeys, and they may or may not comply. There was some discussion on the list months ago that there was some mechanism you go through to get them to do it. But at the end of the day, would you really want them to do that? I mean, if they would supply me the 128-bit keys for my keys, what's to convince me that they wouldn't also supply it to someone else who could somehow convince them that they were me? So in some sense, it's good that they wouldn't supply it or that they make it extremely hard to find out. But instead, they do allow you to reprogram it so you can change it to something you know. Again, so they may comply with someone else requesting your keys. So the idea is reprogram YubiKey with your own IDs and your own AES128-bit key and each YubiKey should have its own AES128-bit key. Once you've done that, reprogrammed keys will no longer work against YubiKo authentication server, so that doesn't work anymore, and there's no way to make it go back to that. I guess you could send it back to YubiKo and they could reprogram it for their server, but again, they're so cheap, you may as well just buy new ones. There's also a mode, I don't know if it actually works in YubiKo 2.0 anymore, sorry about that, but with YubiKo 1.0, you could certainly also program them with a fixed password, so a reusable password. I don't know why you'd want to, but you could have it so that instead of remembering your password, you could just plug your YubiKey in and press the button, and it would tell you your password for you, but of course, anyone running a key scanner or traffic watch or anything else would then see that password. Right. That would work. Or you could use a memory stick for that too, I guess. Yeah. Except you've got to program it, which... Yeah. Okay, some weaknesses. So, first of all, one of the problems, of course, with the whole YubiKey scheme is that it requires a computer to have a USB port, which is going to accept a head keyboard. I'd really like to use my mobile phone to, you know, I run SSH on this and it has a web browser, but there's no way for me to plug a USB keyboard into my mobile phone. It just doesn't have a USB host port on it, port for keyboards. So there's a problem there straight away, and they haven't really come up with a good solution to that. Same with an iPhone or any other sorts of PDAs you might have out there. There are a large number of devices people are using now to access the internet, the web, etc., that just don't have USB keyboard ports on them, and so YubiKeys don't work with them at all. On the other hand, if your computer does have USB ports that allow you to plug in an external keyboard, then you've got another problem altogether, and that is that when you plug a device into your computer, how do you know what that device is going to do? How can you trust it? What if you're running Windows and somebody plugged in a USB keyboard, a device which looked like a USB keyboard, and I have a couple of devices here. That's what it looks like. There's two of them in this little plastic bag here. You can have a look at them later if you like. Cost $12. I can program that to generate keyboard codes, look like a USB keyboard and generate keyboard codes. Now, if I was running Windows, I could program it to generate the key sequence it brings up into an Explorer, type in the URL of a website that I control that is nasty and does cross-site scripting and downloads JavaScript that reads all your bits and pieces, and then shuts the Internet Explorer down again. If your computer trusts devices plugged in as keyboards, then somebody could do that to you. Somebody could plug in a device, which might not immediately do that. It might wait, you know, some random amount of time, and then hopefully when you're not watching, just bring up your some session which is already authenticated as you, type in some commands, and then shut itself down again before you realise what's going on. So it could open up a terminal, for example, and say, copy out the shadow password file or something, hoping that you might be logged in as root or something. So having a device which allows USB keyboards plugged in is a security problem straight away. But everyone does. I mean, every computer that I know of lets you plug in a USB keyboard. But you need to think about just how much are you interested in security if you're allowing random keyboards you plugged in. The second problem or weakness is that the first generation YubiKeys allow you to reprogram without any particular authentication. And so it's possible to run a program on your machine that looks for a YubiKey by its USB ID. When it sees it's been plugged in, just reprograms it straight away and therefore denies you able to use that YubiKey for anything else. Now, if you're away from home, you're relying on YubiKey to connect into, you know, your server and stuff, and somebody reprograms it on you, then you're stuck. In YubiKey 2.0, I actually believe that I recommended this to them way back when. What it does now is when you want to reprogram it, it actually flashes its light, and you've got 8 seconds to press the button. And if you don't press the button within 8 seconds while it's trying to be reprogrammed, while it's telling you it's trying to reprogram by flashing its light, then it cancels that and you have to start all over again. So it now has a mechanism which actually checks to make sure that you really do want it to be reprogrammed. Of course, some of you might plug it in, press the button anyway because they want to get a password. So it still has some problems, but it's a lot better than just simply opportunistically reprogramming. As somebody mentioned at the back there, unused generated keys remain live until the next valid key is used. So it's good policy every now and again just to send the server an authentication request just in case. Yes, suspicious that somebody might have stolen some one-time passwords off you. And, of course, there's nothing to stop somebody from setting up a website that looks like the site you're meant to log into. You type in your username, press the button on your YubiKey, they grab the one-time password, and then they send it to the site that they really wanted to use with a valid, currently valid one-time password. Standard phishing attack. It's not using challenge response, so it can still do that. And there's no authentication going on between the server and the client for the server to guarantee that the client is who it says it is. So those sorts of things still apply, but it's generally still a lot stronger than using reusable passwords. Okay, so I've only got a few minutes left, and I've still got a lot to talk about, so I'm just going to start moving a bit more quickly. I wrote my own authentication server mainly because the implementations that were on YubiKey's website at the time didn't allow me to do the sorts of things that I wanted to do, in particular control who could SSH in. Basically, it was up to each user to put a file into their home directory that said what YubiKeys they would accept using the system that YubiKey came up with, and I didn't want users to control which YubiKeys they were going to use. I wanted to control it centrally. So I went about writing my own authentication server to match YubiKeys against users. Use as much open source technology as possible, write it in C. All good software is written in C. Uses a PostgreSQL database for storing data, pluggable authentication modules, secure socket layers, etc., all that sort of stuff. Probably only compiles against glibc on Linux. I haven't tried compiling it on FreeBSD or Solaris or anything else. Block diagram, that's the code there. It's talking to a Postgres database for storing the actual keys and all the login attempts, where the counters are up to, which IP addresses they came from, all sort of stuff, so that you've got a record of what's going on. It listens on a TCP socket for very simple, here's a username, here's a password, do they match? It also has an SSL interface, so you can talk to it using SSL. And it has an LDAP bind interface, so you can actually fire LDAP bind requests at it. If you're using the PAM LDAP module, it would use this interface here. And you can hang S-Tunnel in front of that if you want to use LDAP-S instead of unencrypted LDAP. So these are your client requests coming in. It also has a Unix domain socket interface here, which talks via some PHP to a Apache web server. And that allows you to insert new keys and all the rest of that sort of stuff, and back up the database, etc. Okay, so it's written as a classic forking server. Can listen on multiple sockets for TCP, SSL, and LDAP authentication requests. Listens on Unix domain sockets for encryption requests for new AES 128-bit keys, and I'll talk about why it does that in a moment. It also has a call out to PAM So it can do two-factor authentication. So you can pass it a username and a password which has the reusable password prepended to the YubiKey password. It'll take the last 44 bytes off the password and do all of its normal authentication for that, and it'll pass the first part of it, thanks, straight through to PAM, and then it can do authentication against a password file or against another LDAP database or whatever you might have going on in PAM. And so it does actually allow you to do the two-factor authentication. The first thing it does when it gets one, it pulls out, it looks up the public key, looks in the database, finds out the 128-bit key, decrypts the packet, checks the CRC, checks the secret ID matches, checks the counters are all moving in the right direction, and does all the right authentication stuff, and then it uses syslog to do all the normal reporting of errant conditions, and we have something that watches the syslog logs to see when something bad happens. Uses PostgreSQL database to store the persistent data, which is what databases are there for. Now, because the database is storing all the 128-bit keys of each YubiKey, we don't want those to leak when the database is backed up and stuff, and so they're all encrypted further in the database. So there's a 128-bit key for the whole server, which gets used to decrypt the 128-bit keys stored in the database. And so that 128-bit key is known only to the database server, but of course it has to sit on the file system as well so that the server can find it. But provided you can keep that secret, it doesn't matter if your standard database backup mechanism leaks the data out. It's unusable. So just a little extra I put in there, and I thought I should talk about debugging tools. You need to test this thing out. You need to test it with good YubiKey one-time passwords and also bad ones. You need keys that go backwards in time, keys that go backwards in session values, and all that sort of stuff. Keys that have incorrect CRCs, invalid secret the first six byte things wrong, etc. And so I wrote a software implementation of YubiKey to do all that, and that's all in the source tree as well. And the other thing that this thing can do is it can generate a one-time pad. Now, what that means is that I can print out, say, 20 successive fake YubiKeys on a piece of paper, carry them around in my wallet. When I want to authenticate, I can actually type in the 44-key thing onto my mobile phone, and it uses the same back-end authentication mechanism as if I'd used a YubiKey. Of course, it's different. It's using a different 128-bit key to my YubiKey, so it knows the difference between the two, but it's using the same back-end infrastructure. So this is how I've worked around. It's a really bodgy workaround, and the next step is actually to write this piece of software to actually run on the mobile phone itself so that so I don't have to type it back in. But there are other issues there, which I'll talk about later. I've also written a program called YK, YubiKey Authentication Server Torture, which is designed to send heaps and heaps of authentication requests really fast and to see what happens under load. Main applications interested in a secure shell, web access, and VPNs. Normal console logins I don't use it with, because if the whole thing fails, I want to still be able to log into my machine and fix it. So you need physical access anyway. And I've used it for unlocking screensavers just because I can, so I can go to my computer when it's screen locked, plug the YubiKey in, press the button, and it unlocks for me. Excuse me. For SSH, we just use PAM module. So PAM talks out through LDAP back to the server, and that all works fine. Similarly, if a web page is written in whatever scripting language you might use, you just call the you call my server as if it's an LDAP server using the LDAP authentication bind mechanisms. That all works. And you can also use TCP sockets from most scripting languages to talk directly to the server. I won't talk about that now, unless someone's interested. It's just a PAM module I wrote. Single sign-on is a dream. Kerberos had a RFC for a while about using one-time passwords with single sign-on, and then went away again. I've got 1 minute to go. Thank you. It's something which I'm still looking into, how you can use something like Kerberos or some other single sign-on system. I prefer to use Kerberos. with a one-time password. And as far as I know, the problem still persists, hasn't been solved. There are some suggested solutions, but nothing's been done. We've started to use it for administration of undergraduate teaching systems. I'm hoping that at the end of this semester, all of our teaching staff will start using it for logging into the teaching systems. And then maybe next year, we've got about 700 or 800 students who use our undergraduate teaching system. We might actually go as far as giving them all one of these. And the links. And that's it.
So for the mode that you did where you could type in the YubiKey value from your on your phone or something, wouldn't it have made more sense to have your custom server also be able to take OATH tokens and then use the large array of OATH clients that have already been written for smart devices?
Yeah, so I've only just started looking at the open authentication system. I haven't really looked at all the different available things. I'm trying to find solutions to help YubiKey because YubiKey's an open system, and I want to find solutions that will help them. But they just don't talk about it. It's like an elephant in the room to them. They're like, let's not talk about PDAs and stuff. We're only, which is a bit
Yeah, I was just checking the YubiKey website, and I don't know if it's very new news or not, but it looks like they've also got an RFID version.
It just came out in the last few weeks. I haven't got one.
Yeah, and also they're supporting OAuth keys.
They do have, I have some here. These two here are OAuth HOTP YubiKeys. So, yeah, I have them. I haven't started playing. I haven't looked into the whole OAuth thing yet. There's a... Right. Yep. Yep. Yeah, so I know there's lots of other things coming around these days I need to look at as well. I think... these guys want to... Are there any more questions or just talk to me?
I'm afraid we're going to have to kick you out.
Okay.
Send you all off to go and have some lunch. Food is good. But on behalf of LCA, thank you very much for your talk. It was actually really quite interesting.
Great, thank you.
And, yeah, take care.